This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankoski. Right now, we're in the midst of a governor's race where polls are telling us all sorts of things. One poll, the traditional Quinnipiac poll, shows Republican challenger Tom Foley with a 6-point lead over incumbent Democrat Dan Malloy. Another poll, Rasmussen, has about the same numbers, but that poll's been cited by many as being slanted toward conservative candidates. Then there's the online YouGov poll, sponsored by CBS News and the New York Times. That poll actually has Governor Malloy up by 1 point, but lots of questions surround this new kind of polling system, whether it truly captures the opinion of the public at large. There are other considerations of these polls, of course, like how petitioning candidate Joe Visconti, an afterthought in most national conversations about this race, pulled a 7% number in that Quinnipiac poll. That result has shut him out of some of the debates, but has opened a door for others, including the one that we will co-host on the 16th. There are also fundraising and enthusiasm considerations. A bad poll result can stall a campaign. A good one can inflate even the longest shot hopes. So, of course, polls matter, but how are they done today? How are they changing, and what can they really tell us about what people think in America? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. Coming up later, we'll talk with someone from Microsoft's new Prediction Lab. It's an interactive platform that offers a unique approach to the way polling is done. But first, I want to welcome in our guest in studio. Jennifer Dineen is Program Director of the Graduate Program in Survey Research at the University of Connecticut. She's Director of the UConn Poll. Good to see you once again, Jennifer. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us from the University of Michigan News Office is Michael Traugott, who's a Director and Research Professor in the Center for Political Studies at the University of Michigan. He's also past President of the American Association for Public Opinion Research. Michael, welcome to our show.
Thank you, John. Good to be with you.
Michael, we'll start with you, and maybe you can take us back to the beginning of this idea of public opinion polling. We think of it as a kind of a modern phenomenon, but how far back does the history go?
Well, it depends, first of all, on what you think of as polling or trying to assess public opinion and preferences. The first kind of measures date back to the beginning of the 19th century. But we think of the modern polling era as starting in the 1930s. It's associated with three leading figures, George Gallup, Elmo Roper, and Archibald Crossley. These were people interested in market research as a business, but they realized they needed a way to publicize their activity and to build a clientele. And so they started public opinion polling at that time in conjunction with news media to build the visibility and the image of their firms. And the history of polling since then has been adaptation to new kinds of methods, employing different kinds of technology. And we've moved from face-to-face interviewing to telephone interviewing to surveys conducted on the web and now increasingly with social media.
And we're going to be talking more coming up in the show about some of those new techniques of collecting this data. And if you want to join us in your thoughts about polling and how it's conducted today, 860-275-7266. We'd also like to hear some of your questions. A lot of people always ask us questions during these political seasons about how polls are conducted and how much we can trust them. I've spoken with a number of people, Michael, in the past who have worked with Gallup, the organization, but you worked with Gallup, the man, George Gallup. Tell me about him and what he was trying to do when he started this world of polling.
Well, a long time ago, I was an undergraduate at Princeton University. And the Gallup organization was headquartered in Princeton. Actually, many firms in the business were located in Princeton. And I answered an ad on a bulletin board one day. They were looking for interviewers, and I started working with the Gallup organization then. And eventually, I worked on the 1964 election campaign and became a research assistant for Dr. Gallup. He was literally a larger-than-life figure. He was a kind of a giant man. He was the most formally trained of the sort of three horsemen of polling in the 1930s. He had a PhD in journalism, but he was also a very savvy businessman and understood this connection and the need for media coverage, and he began his activities by making a deal with the Washington Post to do election coverage for them, and he said that he could do a better job than the leading source of such information at the time, the Literary Digest, and he did. So then he was off and running, and he helped to promote the field as well as his own business.
What did he do that was different than the way others were trying to gather the same data? What was the breakthrough that he had?
Well, he applied scientific methods, as we knew them at the time, to his work, as opposed to the Literary Digest, which was using essentially a large N, big sample approach, where they were mailing out postcards to their subscribers, to people who had registered cars or had a landline telephone. If you imagine who those people might have been during the Depression, you could see how he could identify a Republican bias in their estimation. And he used a system of a national sample with interviewers who contacted people in their homes to obtain the information.
In the modern world, we think of the success of someone like Nate Silver pulling together numbers from a number of different polls and using predictive methods and honestly getting famous because he did really, really well on a few different election cycles. Did something similar happen with George Gallup? I mean, was there something that galvanized the public thought behind the idea that this Gallup poll might be something we should really pay attention to?
Well, I don't think that his innovation is quite on the same order, or was quite on the same order as the one that we associate with Nate Silver, which is much more statistical. But he understood both the relationship between measuring public opinion in the context of representative government and expressing the public's wishes on certain policy or legislative issues through the columns that he wrote. But I think he also was sensitive to an understanding that the public was also interested in what other people thought. And so he also collected data and wrote columns about movie style, other elements of a popular culture beyond politics. So he had a multifaceted approach to collecting and reporting public opinion.
So Jennifer Dineen, talk a bit about how the accuracy of some of these earlier polls and the things that George Gallup was doing in the 1960s, how that compares with what we see in the accuracy of polls today.
Well, there's certainly been an evolution, and I think, you know, to your point, 1936 was a tipping point, right? The Literary Digest was wrong, and Gallup and Roper were right, and shortly their careers took off, and shortly after that, the Literary Digest folded. So there was certainly some of that. I think the difference between those days and what we see now is continually evolving understanding about how accurate the methods can be, the different sources of error that are involved in measurement, right? Polls are estimations, and they're presenting pictures of certain times. They're not necessarily predictive, and we understand much more about how all of the different components that go into polling impact that accuracy and the picture we draw now.
Well, one of the things that Michael was talking about, though, that I found fascinating is going back to the early days of polling, that there were one-on-one interviews as one of the techniques. And we think about the different ways in which you can interact with a pollster, whether or not that's signing up for a YouGov poll and saying, I want to put information
right.
in, or having somebody cold call you while you're in the middle of putting some pasta in your mouth at dinner time. You know, all of these things are very, very different. But it seems as though, thinking back about a time in which we actually had to sit down, interview one-on-one, in one way that might get you a lot of the information you want. In one way, Jennifer, that might be very, very limiting. What do you think about that?
It's both of those things.
Yeah.
And so on the one hand, in terms of what the interviewer can see, and both in terms of the asking the questions, but also observe, it would be much harder for me in a face-to-face situation to pretend to be an 80-year-old man living in New York City, because somebody's sitting in my living room with me looking at me. And so there's a certain amount of information that you can validate when you see people. On the other hand, the time of data collection and the cost associated with sending interviewers out all over the country were significant for both. And so as technology has moved along, as we've transitioned to phone and web in some part, we have shortened the amount of data collection time, which means that when it comes to elections, we can give pictures closer and closer to election day. And it's decreased the cost, which makes it, you know, is a large part of what's proliferated polls, I think.
And we're going to turn now to some of the new styles and methods of collecting this information. If you have questions about that, 860-275-7266. Before we bring in our next guest, Jennifer, I'll just ask you to sort of talk about the difference between when we say, on one hand, there's a governor's poll that says, you know, Tom Foley's up by 6 points. It's the Quinnipiac poll. Right. They call you. And then there's the other thing. There's this New York Times, CBS News, YouGov poll in which it's done online. Could you just lay out for us, Jennifer, how those two things are different?
Sure. I mean, one of the most significant ways that those two things are different are the basis of their sample. So the voting population, in your example, Connecticut is the population that we're going to take a sample from, a group from. When you're using a telephone methodology, and Quinnipiac uses both landlines and cellular phones, you're able to randomly generate phone numbers, which means you're able to randomly select respondents. When you're using an internet-based methodology, respondents are opting in. In some ways, they're self-selecting. They're signing up. They're agreeing to participate. They're choosing to go to the site, answer the website. And so there's a bit of a difference in terms of the composition of the sample.
And I'll say, and what I know about that composition is, look, when we talk about politics here, we know that on the radio, a certain type of person wants to listen to political horse race coverage. They're political junkies. They care about that stuff. They might sign up for an online poll in a much different way than someone who just, you know, listens a little bit. Does that really influence the result of the poll?
It can a little bit. I mean, we know that, first of all, when you're doing the online poll, voters who don't use the internet or don't use the internet very much don't have an opportunity to be selected. So we're taking part of the eligible population out and we're not asking them their opinion. With election polling, there's a little, I think it's unclear. Mike might be able to speak to this better, but your likelihood of participating, of signing up to do something, might be related to your likelihood of actually showing up to vote. And so I think the issue there is more with the sample than it is with the propensity to be a participator.
Michael, do you have a thought on that?
Well, the concept of the electorate is something that, in a certain sense, doesn't exist until election day itself. So part of the estimation process involves not only who you talk to and the, you know, and the kinds of questions that you ask them, but then an adjustment that's made to the data based upon the concept of the likely electorate or likely voter model. And this is a kind of secret sauce in the business that varies from firm to firm without much disclosure of the specific details. So a lot of the new methods and a lot of the evaluation of the new methods based upon what we know about them has to do with what the frame for sampling is, how close it gets, for example, to registered voters to begin with, what kind of likely voter model is used. But I think it's also important to point out that some firms are collecting data for multiple purposes. So they want to estimate the outcome of the election based upon this likely voter subgroup. But they also want to talk about presidential approval, which is ordinarily measured for adults 18 years of age and over. So there are compromises that are made based upon the ways in which the data are going to be used that can also affect the quality of the estimation.
Let me bring into the conversation Andrew Gelman, who's a professor of statistics and political science and director of the Applied Statistics Center at Columbia University. He wrote about this phenomenon in the Washington Post and the questions that people have about new-style online polling versus the traditional phone-based polling that we've known for so many years. Andrew, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, sure. It's been a pleasure to listen, actually. A lot of wisdom coming over the air.
Well, I'm wondering if maybe you can pick up on some of that wisdom and where you think we should really be going, because I think in our state, as I just laid out, there's been a lot of skepticism about these new online polls. Some people say, well, the New York Times is doing it. It must work very, very well. You've called for more innovation in polling. Maybe you can pick up on some of the conversation you've heard so far.
I think any innovative method is going to come out because it has something to offer compared to an old method. Maybe it's that it's cheaper, or that there are certain niches where the old method has problems and the innovation is necessary. So there, traditionally in survey research, there have been problems where traditional methods don't work so well, or where traditional methods are a bit expensive, and that motivates new approaches. That doesn't mean the old approaches are no good. It just means different approaches have different niches where they'll work better or worse.
What do you see as some of the problems in 2014 with the traditional methods that we've known for such a long time?
Non-response rates are on the order of 90%. So even if you have a random sample, it's essentially an opt-in sample in that you're only getting the people who chose to respond to the survey in the first place.
So that's a big piece of it. What about this question about when people are opting in, going to the computer and deciding to sign up? Are you really getting a representative sample of the entire population? Obviously, a lot of people have phones. Many, many people have the internet, but not anywhere near the same sort of numbers. Does that matter?
A lot of people don't have landlines, too. A lot of people don't answer their phones when a pollster is calling. What I've seen of internet polls is they can be less representative of the population compared to a phone survey. And it's necessary, whether you do a phone survey or an internet survey, it's going to be necessary to adjust the sample to match to the population.
And Jennifer, just for our audience, explain a little bit about how that's done. You talk about adjusting the sample. I mean, without getting into the gory mathematical details too much, I mean, what is he talking about there, Jennifer?
What he's talking about is a process that we call weighting, where we do some math to make the demographics or the characteristics of the sample, so the percentage of men and women and different racial and ethnic groups, match the percentage of the population. And so what we might do if women, let's say, are overrepresented in our sample, we might actually treat their responses a little lighter, and treat the responses of men a little heavier, give them a little bit more weight to make some adjustments so that our sample looks like the population it's supposed to represent.
So, Andrew, is there, for us, we're seeing some of this online polling in this election cycle really for the first time coming to the fore, at least in the public consciousness. And I think when we get to the 2016 presidential election, when it comes to politics, this is going to play a huge, huge role. What do you see as changes that we might even see over the course of the next couple years as we learn how to better weight these samples, as to how to better represent the public at large with the polls that we do conduct?
I don't think from the outside it's going to look so different. You're still going to have media organizations reporting polls. I don't think it'll look so differently. The analogy I like is comparing, not for surveys, but comparing traditional telephones to cell phones. Cell phones have lower sound quality, and you'd never think anybody would use them, but they're so convenient. And in a sense, internet polls might be like that. Like, there are ways in which the data aren't as clean as a telephone poll, but they're very convenient. You can sort of do them anywhere, and that I think that's going to motivate their continued use in the same way that people keep using cell phones.
You know, John, I think one of the points is, and I like Andrew's point, from the outside it doesn't look any different. I don't think the way that the public consumes polls should be different. And so whether it is internet-based polls or telephone polls, I would never take a picture of anything with just one shot. Right? And it's not one particular survey that helps us see what's going on in Connecticut. I think it's looking at all of them or as many of them as you can trying to see where the differences are, where the similarities are, and looking beyond the top line numbers.
And that was my next point, is we talk about the top line numbers, and those are the ones that not only get the headlines, but they also drive a lot of decisions in the media. They drive a lot of decisions on the campaign trail. But this question of getting beyond that top line into some deeper thoughts about how people really feel about things. Do you feel, Jennifer, and I'd like Andrew and Mike to also weigh in on this, do you feel as though we're able to get a little bit more depth of how people truly feel about some key issues, some things that go beyond, you know, 57% versus 45% or whatever?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think in your example, if you looked at those Quinnipiac numbers, they asked questions about the importance of certain issues in the votes, and then you can see how the different candidates do on those issues. They ask whether the vote was for a candidate or against another. I think there's a lot of insight in those questions that help us assess the strength of the support, how real the numbers are. And then there's also the consistency of numbers to numbers. It's probably a close race, but there's a certain realm that, you know, candidates are not getting over 50%. And so I think that looking at those things together helps you see what's there.
Andrew, I mean, do you think that we're able, with more innovative polling techniques, able to get at some of the real key questions? I mean, the issue ideas that we in the media are always begging for. I mean, we want to know what people think about real issues, but we tend to always just default to which of the two guys do you like. But do you think that these online polling techniques might allow us a little bit better depth of understanding about how people really feel about important issues?
Possibly. One advantage of an online poll is it's easier to come back and interview somebody again. So you can ask people the same question twice, and you can see whether they've changed their view, or you can even directly ask them, have you changed your view or why? It's harder in a telephone poll or a face-to-face poll. These are sometimes done as a panel where you survey people repeatedly, but it's harder and very rarely done. With an internet poll, it's pretty effortless, and it's done very commonly to survey people over and over.
And Michael Traugott, before we take a break, I'd just like to get your thoughts on this. I mean, what advantages do you think that online polling can give us right now and moving forward in the next couple election cycles here?
Well, I'd like to make two different kinds of comments. First of all, there's a difference between the kinds of explanations you can derive from a survey, a questionnaire, as opposed to data that are collected for a predictive model. For example, as the way Nate Silver operates and functions, the explanations he provides beyond the estimates of the outcome that he makes is a secondary derivative of his familiarity with the results of other polls or from political science theory or models, but they don't come from data that he collected. The other point I'd like to make is that when we think about the future of polling, I think it's probably going to involve more multi-mode designs, the assembly of information using a similar questionnaire, but from contact with people based upon landline phones, cell phones, the internet, and so on. So the application of technology to the survey business has, especially in the media, has been a story about reducing costs and the time of data collection. But I think that we're pretty close to achieving all of the cost reductions that we can, and we're now going to enter a period in which the costs are going to rise because of the increasing complexity of the designs.
Andrew Gelman, does that sound right to you?
Yeah.
Andrew Gelman, professor of statistics and political science, director of the Applied Sciences Center at Columbia University. Thanks so much for joining us for a few minutes, sir. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to take some of your calls and questions at 860-275-7266 with polling experts. How are polls conducted? What is a good question? What's a bad question to ask in a poll? We're going to find out a little bit more about how this work is done. You can always email us where we live at WNPR.org. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about polls and polling and how it's changed over the years. Michael Traugott's been involved in polling for years. He's director and research professor in the Center for Political Studies at the University of Michigan. He's also past president of the American Association for Public Opinion Research. He joins us from the offices of Michigan News. Jennifer Dineen is here, program director of the graduate program in survey research at UConn, director of the UConn poll. We're going to take some of your calls about polls and how they work. Maybe you can tell us some of the polling questions you have. I'm sure that you've been getting calls from pollsters at home. We want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. Jennifer, we talked earlier about that response rate being around 10% to people who respond to the cold call, you know, the call that comes from a Quinnipiac poll. Right. Why is it so low?
I think it's so low for a couple of reasons. One is that, as I said before, polls have proliferated, and so there's lots more of us calling people far more frequently than there used to be. But people's lives are busier. I think people don't all live that traditional schedule where we used to come home for dinner at a certain time and be home to get the call when you have the pasta in your mouth. And so I think it's a lot of those things. I think caller ID, which is everywhere, you don't necessarily sign up for it. It's on all sorts of phones, also means that people know there's less of those accidental answers, right? If you don't recognize the number, you don't necessarily stop eating to take the call.
Yeah. So if you think about response rates for online, is there any way to do an apples-to-apples comparison for something like a YouGov poll where people are opting in saying, I want to take part in polling?
Well, no. I mean, they can figure out their cooperation rates based on, I think, how many invitations they send out to a particular poll. But, I mean, one of the things I think that's important to note is that the literature on whether or not a low response rate has a big impact on the data is pretty mixed. And some of the literature says, no, it doesn't necessarily. I mean, this is a complex methodology, and there's multiple sources of error, right? We tend to hang our hats publicly on the things that are easy to explain to people and to quantify. So sampling error, right? Everybody now knows what that margin of error is in terms of the plus or minus three. We talk about response rates. But you can have, and the literature shows, a survey with a relatively low response rate in the 10% range that has similar data quality to a comparable survey with a high response rate. I mean, we also, what's really important is how we ask the question, the orders we ask the question. You know, Mike's point about how we screen for likely voters, when there's all sorts of potential sources of error that I think are as important, if not more important, to minimize than response rate. We just can't measure them the same way.
Michael, I'm wondering if you can talk about this idea of how we ask the questions, even the questions we ask. This is a fascinating piece of this entire world that I have to admit I don't entirely understand. I ask questions all the time. Sometimes I ask them well, and sometimes I ask them poorly. But for someone conducting a poll, it's really, really important the specific words you use. Talk about that art or science as part of what you doing with polling?
Well, I would begin, John, by saying that we think of this as a science in the sense that there's been a lot of research conducted on this and across a long period of time. We know that there can be effects, and when we say effects, we mean the potential for bias that are associated with the structure of the question and the exact words that are used. So we talk about leading phrases, for example, that try to take the respondent in one direction or another. There are elements of social desirability associated with certain topics. So most people know that being a good citizen in a democracy implies that you vote. So when we ask people about either their past voting behavior or their intended vote in the upcoming election, we always get over reports of this. We have to make adjustments for that. We know that the order in which the questions are asked, what we call context effects, can be important because prior questions can affect the answers that people give to subsequent questions. And we know that there are also differences in patterns of response that are associated with the mode of the interview. On the telephone, there's a tendency for respondents to give the last option that they were given on the telephone, while in paper and pencil questionnaires, for example, there's a tendency to select the first one. So there's quite a bit of science associated with this. In pre-election polling, the most serious problem we have is the overestimate that people give about their intention to vote. And the turnout figures are too high. There has been research that shows the order in which you offer the names of the candidates, or whether or not you associate party identification with them or just give the names, can have a difference in the response patterns as well. It's difficult in the context of any specific survey to estimate whether these issues will arise and how great they'll be, but there are approaches or techniques, for example, altering the wording for a random half of the sample in one way as opposed to another way for the other random half, and to look and see whether there are differences. But that only comes up after all the data are collected.
Do you have some more thoughts on this, Jennifer? Because to us, in our world of asking questions and trying to get people to say things back to us, it's fascinating, this idea of putting some scientific method to it and actually being able to see, well, yeah, asking questions in a certain manner is going to change the way not only this particular respondent might respond, but a whole group of people, which can be very, very important.
Right. I mean, one of the things we do, and one of the great things that technology has allowed us to do, is to mitigate some of these things. So in the candidate question, we can have the order randomly appear, not just in half, but for all of the respondents. And so we can protect against the bias that way. And we can rotate blocks of questions. And so one particular question doesn't lead into something else consistently, and having that kind of consistent context effect. So we can do those things. But there's a lot of research and a lot of science behind this, but there is also some common sense that we have to apply, and some things you learn as you go through on how you protect. You know, you wouldn't ask a question that went something like, scientists have told us smoking is bad for your health. Do you smoke? Because you're leading the respondent to not want to tell you the truth if they do. And so I think Mike's points are right on.
Well, one of the things that I thought about, and I should have brought in the numbers from this most recent Quinnipiac poll, but bear with me as I remember them as I remember them from the sheet. When asked questions about Dan Malloy and the job he was doing, it seemed as though more than half, certainly, of the respondents felt as though he was trustworthy. You could trust him in various situations. He was someone who, by all accounts, the polling, when asked very specific questions, was saying, we like Dan Malloy, and we think Dan Malloy is doing a good job. But then the broader question of, do you think that he's the person to handle, you know, the economy or the next 4 years, they all seemed to tank for him. How is it that we can paint a picture that seems to suggest that, when asked very specific questions, is he good at this, 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 and this, people say thumbs up. But then when asked the more general question, but would you like somebody else to do the job, they go thumbs down.
Yeah, and that's part of what I mean by looking beyond the horse race. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I think you're right. I think on the personality characteristics, trustworthiness, leadership,
yes,
the governor did well. More than half of the people gave him positive ratings there. On specific issues, the economy, taxes, and I think managing the balance of tax and spend, he did not do as well. There could be some partisanship there. There could be a little bit of people just unhappy with the slow comeback of the economy, and so they may be attaching that to the governor's ratings without actually thinking so much through whether or not the governor is responsible for those things. There could be a partisanship there.
Well,
he's a Democrat.
That partisanship, though, is something that I want to put to Michael Traugott quickly, because you've been doing this for a long time, and we have the sense, Michael, that we are more partisan as a society than we've ever been. We're more divided. The media is certainly very divided. And if you identify as a Republican, you almost never have anything good to say about the Democrats or the other way around. Do you think that that has substantially changed the way people respond to polls, and it's actually changed the data that you're able to collect over the years?
Well, I'll try to answer this in two ways. You know, the partisanship party ID is a concept that was developed at the University of Michigan in the 1950s and 60s. And over time, we saw the relationship between partisanship and party ID and voting decline a little bit, but the strength of that association is now growing again. So there's no question that partisanship is important. And we also have situations, especially in legislative elections, where redistricting has made more homogeneous constituencies, and that means that there are fewer contested races. So partisanship, or its manifestation as polarization, shows up in that context as well. So party, I would say, party ID is reasserting itself as a as an explanatory variable. But of course, in any particular contest, we have to take the attributes of the candidates into account as well. And incumbency is generally thought of as an advantage, although mostly in pre-campaign ways, the ability to raise money, organize a field staff, and so on. There's an increasing dissatisfaction of with government that we see nowadays in the electorate, and that doesn't always work to the advantage of people who are currently holding office.
Michael, a last thing for you before we take our break. I still get people all the time, despite the number of statistics that are in the news every single day. People are always coming to me and saying, you know, can I trust this poll? They talk to 1,000 people or 1,200 people. Is that really a representative sample of what the state feels or what the country might feel? Explain very quickly, if you could, your elevator speech to our listeners about why the way polls are done right now are something you really can trust if done right.
The science of sampling says that a sample of the size of 1,000 is sufficient to make a reasonable estimate of how the public feels or how the public reports it will behave. The best analogy is to think about going to the doctor and telling, and the doctor saying, we need to take some blood to find out about your condition. They don't extract all of your blood. They they just take a little bit that they can examine. Now, the question of sample size is independent of the sample design, though. I mean, how do you assemble the frame of the eligible or target population, and what method do you use to draw the number that will give you 1,000 interviews in the end? That's a different issue, and there's a lot of variation there, and that's an area where things could go wrong.
Michael Traugott is director and research professor in the Center for Political Studies at the University of Michigan, past president of the American Association of Public Opinion Research. Thank you so much, sir, for your time. I appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
We got this email from Melanie. She says, I wouldn't mind participating in a poll if I knew that it's a legitimate organization trying to do unbiased work, but most of the calls I get sound like they're really a marketing ploy, and I hang up. How can I know when those calls come in whether it's a legitimate poll or not? We'll ask that question of Jennifer Dineen. We'll also talk about Microsoft getting into the prediction game, literally. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, a recent forum at the Yale Law School opened conversation about the nation's agricultural gag laws. We'll continue that conversation about farming practices in the U.S. We'll also take a look at Connecticut's rich farm history and some recent efforts to preserve and celebrate it. That's tomorrow's Where We Live. Today we're talking about polling with some pollsters. Jennifer Dineen is a program director of the graduate program in survey research at UConn, the director of the UConn poll. Joining us now by phone is David Rothschild, who's a researcher for Microsoft, which just launched the Microsoft Prediction Lab. And David, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be on.
So what is the Prediction Lab? Explain it to us.
The Prediction Lab is our attempt to really centralize a lot of the research that we've been doing into non-probability and non-representative polling and prediction games, other methods of gathering people's information, their ideas, their sentiment, their expectations, and creating an understanding of what's going to happen now, what's going to happen in the future, rather than using the random non-representative people that are standard in polling, but actually using people who opt in or people that you can get with more convenience.
So describe for us a little bit in more detail, if our listeners are trying to understand how this might be different than signing up for the New York Times YouGov poll or getting a call from Quinnipiac University, what exactly is different in the interface here?
Yeah, definitely. So I thought that the last, right before you went to the break, was a great lead-in. You guys had talked a little bit about survey errors, so the question order and the question wording, and you talked a little bit about sample error, so this question of did you get enough people from the representative population. One of the biggest issues right now, as Michael was saying right before the break, is it's harder and harder to figure out what that population is. And so standardized polling, you're going to try to get a lot of coverage. You want the entire United States population, and traditionally it's done by the landlines, and it's done by cell phone numbers now. And you try to get a random person to respond. And so you have this question of both, can you get the entire country, and can you get the random person to respond? And what we're seeing is increasingly harder to get full coverage, so there's kind of a coverage error, and increasingly lower response rates, which have now dropped below 9% for standard polling. So when a polling company like Quinnipiac or Gallup randomly chooses a phone number to call, they're getting very low response rates, and there's a lot of selection issues that goes along with that. So what we're saying is, let's open this up. Let's see if we can get people to come in and start learning how can you actually take people who just opt in. So this is a much lower coverage. We're not getting the entire population, and it's not random in any respect. But if they provide enough information about themselves, can we actually overcome some of those biases from not having the full United States and not having the people be random? And we've had really good experience with it in the past. In 2012, we ran an experiment on Xbox where we had over 350,000 people sign up, provide some key demographics, and we were able to track in all 50 states the pollster rolling average of the major polling for the Obama-Romney election. And so this is another foray into seeing how we can open this up to even more questions and even more different coverage of beyond politics and ultimately in the future.
But the interface, from what I understand, is a little bit more like what you might expect from the Xbox than what you might expect from the old traditional landline telephone. Explain that a little bit and why that is important.
So a lot of the experimentation that we're going beyond polling and thinking in terms of incentivizing in a game structure even. So sometimes people may be asked polling of, who would you vote for if the election were held today, or the expectation question, which we're very happy with, which is who do you think is going to win your state? But other times, we're actually allowing people to play a game where they essentially say, what's the probability that a candidate in a given state is going to win? And this is pulling off of prediction market research in which there are contracts for, say, whether or not Obama is going to be elected in 2012. You could have canonically, it was worth $1 if he'd won, it was worth $0 if he didn't win, and the price of that contract was extremely, extremely close to the underlying probability of whether or not Obama was going to win the election. And so by utilizing that concept, we have these games mixed in with the polling, and really we're pushing on all cylinders. We see the prospect of using users who opt in either this polling or prediction place, a way that we can kind of move beyond more sluggish polling, get some really quickly updating, time-granular understanding of what's going on, which will allow us to see the impact of events. It's a lot more cost-effective as polling becomes increasingly expensive. If we can get the accuracy here, it's a lot cheaper, and that will allow us to ask more questions and talk about, we have all 507 major races there, including all 435 House races, and if we can show some accuracy in all 435 House races, that really expands beyond what traditional polling is really capable of doing because of the increased cost.
Well, Jennifer Danina, I'd love some of your thoughts on this. And one of the things I'm thinking about as he's talking is the fact that, you know, polling isn't necessarily meant to be predictive. It's not always meant to say who is going to win. It's a snapshot of what people are saying to you at the time. But we certainly think of it as being predictive. We think of it in that way. Another thing we think of as being predictive is like, what's the Vegas line say? I mean, all across the world, where people put their money down actually can be a pretty good predictor of how things are going to turn out. Not always. I guess I'm wondering in that context, what you think of what David's doing with Microsoft here, how you think it might augment some of the traditional polling methods.
Well, yes, certainly. I think you're right. Whether or not whether or not polling in itself is a predictive methodology, we are looking for predictions as a society. And so what David's talking about might do that. You know, what's especially intriguing is the idea of having some sense of what's going on in all of the House races or some of those lower under-ticket races that you can't afford to poll in across the country. There is definitely a data desert when it comes to publicly released information and getting a sense of what's going on some of those smaller levels.
You know, earlier on in the program, David, we got a little bit of a history lesson about George Gallup and some of the pioneers of polling and why they really got into the business in the first place. And it wasn't just because they wanted to run a polling institute. They were trying to build a business model as well. Very quickly, what's in it for Microsoft to do all this?
That's a great question. You know, we're really excited to be able to be doing a lot of the forefront research on this and a lot of the conversation involving the YouGov poll and the New York Times, et cetera, the stuff that I was able to be in the center of. And so for one thing, Microsoft really does want to be in cutting-edge research and seeing where that takes it. And for us, it's a matter of learning the best techniques and seeing the fact that we do have a lot of users, and these users are coming onto different sites, and maybe this can be used to provide a public good. And at this point, this is not really anything more than an attempt by us to learn more about what is really cutting-edge research. I mean, you bring up George Gallup and all that stuff, and it was really obviously a very canonical, very great examples about what happened in 1936, but there's been a lack of movement in the industry compared to other things when you see about technology, about internet, about computers, about the ability to reach people extremely quickly, about the ability to compute large amounts of data very quickly. And we see this as really a growth opportunity, as something in which there is just endless possibilities. And so clearly down the line, there's going to be a lot of market intelligence in a multi-billion dollar industry, and it's going to be transformed because if I said on one hand I worry about the future of survey research because of declining response rates and coverage error, I also see this problem, this possibility of if all these people on the internet that come and just easily give information on the phone and gaming systems who are used to responding to things and providing things very simply, if they could be harnessed, the possibilities to understand the world in ways that we couldn't possibly imagine. You know, we're just talking about the House races, but it goes well beyond that. It's talking about a lot of issues. What are the impact of elections on likely policy outcomes? These are things you can start asking about and learning about that were previously very difficult.
David Rothschild is a researcher from Microsoft, which launched their Microsoft Prediction Lab. David, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me on.
In just the last minute or so that we have, I'd love an answer to the question that we got from Melanie Jennifer. She's basically saying, you know, I get these calls. It sounds like it's a marketing ploy. You already said a lot of people have caller ID. I don't want to answer a call. I mean, how do you know that it's a legit poll that's asking you questions that you might want to take part in?
Sure. Well, the interviewer on the phone should be willing to answer some basic questions. They should be willing to tell you where they're calling from. And so identify their source if it's a university or a phone center. They should also be willing to tell you who's sponsoring the research and whether or not it will be released publicly and how and when you would be able to see that data. If they're willing to give you answers to those questions, then it's likely to be an opinion poll and done for a legitimate purpose. There may be callers that are calling for legitimate market research purposes, but they probably won't share as much of that information.
And every once in a while, you just look at the push poll, you know, somebody who's actually trying to use the guise of the public opinion
right.
poll to actually get in your mind an idea about a candidate. And those are still out there, right?
They are still out there. They are definitely still out there. You have to watch for those.
Well, hopefully we'll have a lot of good information coming between now and November 4th about what's going to happen in the governor's race. But we're always fascinated to talk about polls. Jennifer, thank you so much for being here.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
Jennifer Dineen is program director of the graduate program in survey research at UConn, the director of the UConn poll. You can always continue the conversation online. Go to WNPR.org. Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.